Thank you all so much. This is really great. I didn't know who I'd be paired with, but this makes for a really interesting transition because the organization I'm going to talk about, it will be interesting to put it into conversation with the critiques of individualizing HIV interventions and managerialism in HIV interventions and neoliberalism. So I'm going to talk about formalizing labor facilitating health, the impact of a community-led cooperative bank on sex worker well-being in Calcutta, India. I don't have anything to disclose. So I'm going to have to review a lot of information very quickly to kind of get to the meat of the study, so bear with me. But in general, economic insecurity has been linked with HIV risk. And this has been particularly the case with sex workers for whom ability to earn money is directly linked with HIV risk and sexual behavior. This is due in part to the willingness of clients to pay more for unprotected sex in some instances, the economic need that drives sex workers to riskier sex work situations that may impede successful condom negotiation, and then also economic dependence on power brokers that leads to a lack of sex worker bargaining power with other individuals working in the profession like madams, pimps, and others. And so in response to this issue, microfinance has been proposed as a structural HIV intervention. And particularly with sex workers. And as you can see developing in the literature, there are existing interventions beginning to develop with sex worker groups. Primarily, these existing interventions in the literature support alternative income generation, often with an HIV education component. So usually what happens is there's some sort of financial asset building program, some job training to exit sex work, and also to educate sex workers about HIV risk and transmission, etc. And this literature has seen some decrease in commercial sex partners, which you think about that as an outcome can be certainly problematic, and increased condom use. So given the parameters of the outcomes these existing interventions have been seeking, there have been some successes. However, there are some really acute critiques of this model. Practically, they're highly limited in scale, scope, and sustainability. So the programs themselves provide very limited financial support, not nearly the kind of money that is made often in sex work, and not the kind of money you can support a family on or an individual on. Also, these programs reach relatively small numbers of sex workers, right? So these are mostly pilot studies. They work with 20 sex workers here, 100 sex workers here in a community, very kind of community level thinking, but don't impact the lives of many sex workers. And then finally, they are exclusively driven by outside resources. So they're contingent on grant funding, on outside researcher initiative, even though some are led by like community advisory boards. They're still primarily led by outside researchers and outside academics. But then there's also a broader conceptual limitation to this type of intervention, right? So they're oriented almost exclusively toward exit from sex work and therefore don't offer any kind of protection to the much larger active population of sex workers who are daily dealing with negotiations around HIV health and broader health, right? It's also very limited to HIV health. And then also these interventions are subject to the broader critiques of microfinance itself. So there have been very strong critiques of microfinance in that it perpetuates an informal labor market, lacking any form of organized labor protection. So most people in microfinance programs, it's the provision of small loans, small scale savings programs that facilitate entrepreneurial activity, right? But this kind of ushers people into a very unprotected labor market with very little support. It's also highly individual, so it does not address the needs at the community level or provide support for those unable to engage in income generation. And then finally, it misses the big picture, right? It's as if you can end poverty with little individual businesses rather than thinking about some of the larger structural drivers of poverty and economic vulnerability in any population, but particularly in sex workers. And so the research I'm going to talk about today is research that was part of my dissertation work that was a case study of the Usha Multipurpose Cooperative Society. And this is a cooperative bank that was organized in Calcutta, India, as the part of a collectivizing process of a group of sex workers. So in the early 90s, sex workers came together in the red light districts of Calcutta to create essentially a workers' union. And early on, it became very clear that addressing economic exploitation within the red light community was going to be an extremely important part of the organizing activities, and so they created the Usha Cooperative Bank, which is officially registered with the West Bengal Cooperative Society as a workers' cooperative. The story of doing that alone is a very interesting, interesting story. So I'm going to go quickly through methods because I do want to get to the meat of this. For field work, I collected 60 individual and small group interviews with Usha members. I tried to get the widest variety of members possible, so both present members, members that left. There are rural fields. There are folks in the most dense red light district. I also did 20 in-depth interviews and focus groups with Usha and Durbar key informants, so staff, leadership, some of the older founding members, and also outside consultants who currently work with the bank, as well as Durbar leadership to get a sense of the relationship between the two organizations. And I also conducted participant observations in the office and board meetings in the Red Light District, which is actually some of the richest data that came out of this. I used a modified grounded theory, so I collected and analyzed iteratively, and then with a full data set, I underwent several rounds of coding and took some specific approaches to rigor, which we can talk about after if anybody's interested in the methodology of it. So results, I found that Usha generates labor protection on a multi-level manner, so at the individual, community, and socio-political levels. Kaylin, will you bring my water bottle up? Thank you. So first, at the first level, I found that Usha generates an individual financial safety net, which provides some worker protection.
Thank you.
So previous to Usha, sex workers in this community did not have access to any formal mechanisms for saving. This is due in part to actually geographical access, but also highly due to stigma and formal banking institutions, which excluded their participation in these organizations. And so this made it very difficult for sex workers to manage their individual finances. And so through Usha savings and loans, members are able to create their own sort of safety net to address household needs. For example, the creation of a sort of ad hoc sick leave, right? So previous to Usha, you sort of were operating in a survival paradigm where you had to see clients no matter what because you didn't have any sort of even small safety net to fall back on to take some time off, to care for yourself. And so, for example, this woman says, I've saved this money for my future because I'm HIV positive and at any time I can get sick and I need the security for health checkups or treatment. And I want to remain self-supported. So this idea of self-reliance, though very neoliberal, and we'll get to that, was very important to the women with whom I spoke. So this idea that you would not have to depend on your children, particularly you would not have to depend on a partner. In addition to sick leave, a lot of women spoke about planning for retirement, and so the thought of not being able to rely necessarily on kinship systems to support yourself after you are no longer a productive worker was a high priority for women who used Usha programs to save, essentially for like a pension plan. And then also the act of participating in a financial program also developed in some women sort of the knowledge to push into some of their labor relations with the power brokers with whom they worked. So madams, dalal, babus, which is like a long-term partner, once they were saving more regularly, there was a greater sense of ownership over the monetary exchange that was happening as a part of sex work, and therefore questioning. So this woman talks about demanding greater transparency in her labor relationships as a part of participating in Usha programs. So this is all, really important, but it's highly individual. So this is the classic sort of narrative of self-sufficiency, of responsibilization, right? I earn, I educate myself, I learn how to save money, and this institution gives me the opportunity to save and provide for myself. And so, though important and though very valued by members at USHA, this is not enough to make any sort of substantive change in economic vulnerability for sex workers in general in Calcutta. And so, you see, as a part of a community organization, that the impact grows beyond the individual to making some community-level changes. You know, at the next sort of level, USHA participation and the creation of USHA organization started to undermine some of the problematic power dynamics within the community. So previous to USHA, women were dependent on moneylenders, they were dependent on madams, on partners, and there was this bottomless trap of debt burden. And this has impacts on health and on HIV health. So when you have no negotiating power, it's very difficult to assert yourself, to, you know, demand safe professional practices, like condom use, et cetera. And again, this sort of opacity in terms of labor relations and monetary exchange. And so not only did individual saving, sort of enable women to have greater control over their own decision-making processes as sex workers, but due to the overall collectivization of sex workers and the greater control sex workers had over their finances, there was an actual shift in the power dynamics at the community level. So it wasn't just dependent on your own ability to assert yourself with your madam. There was a shift in the power and the role of madams in the red light district in general. This is also augmented by the fact that through USHA savings, many sex workers, again, were able to move beyond a survival paradigm to invest in buildings, in real estate, and then became more like subletters rather than madams who exerted specific control over sex workers. So as sex workers had the ability to invest, that dynamic also changed. So there's this overall shift in exploitation and the processes of exploitation in the community. So then beyond this, USHA invests in various business activities which provide income to the institution. And through this process, the bank itself has created sort of a system of collective redistribution to provide both social welfare grants for those who are unable to earn income and therefore provide for themselves. But it has also sort of given back into the union system, which creates a whole network of non-income contingent supportive services that you don't need to be individually generating to have access to. And this is a wide range of services provided by the union, including education, vocational training, alternative work opportunities if you are looking to find an alternative to sex work. They have a really incredible self-regulatory system to deal with trafficking in minors in the red light district. Cultural programs, and these forms of empowerment have been linked to HIV risk and HIV negotiation. And then finally, and I think in many ways most powerfully, USHA has been able to financially and symbolically support the social movement building of an international sex workers' rights movement that has found a lot of central power in Soniwatchi, in the red light district of Calcutta specifically. And so USHA is able to use some of the funds generated through their programming to fund social activism. And so one of the Durbar leaders, you know, explains in this quote that nobody is giving funding for social activism, right? The union and the health clinics that have been set up through some of the organizing that has happened in the red light district do get major grant funding, like Ford Foundation, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, but those monies have a lot of strings attached to them. And so through this cooperative bank and through the money that's generated through this cooperative banking system, they're able to, the organization, the union, is able to stay financially independent, to engage in the kind of activism that, that would only happen if self-funded. And so this is a broader, you know, a collective action, sort of in the streets demonstration, grassroots movement to shift how, to shift public opinion of sex work, to shift the legal standing of sex work. And this is how you access those structural drivers of poverty and the structural drivers of HIV risk in a sex worker community. Addressing HIV health, but then also other forms of health, right? So addressing issues like maternity leave, issues like sick leave, issues like old age or retirement pensions, are the types of health advocacy work that the union does that is funded through the OSHA Bank. And so in this way, labor protection facilitated by OSHA advances sex workers beyond a survival paradigm and allows the community to prioritize health at the individual, community, and socio-political levels. I think it's a really interesting case study, and more than anything, just kind of opens up how we can think about economic interventions as a multi-level intervention. I wish I had the sociological framework with the levels of where this works. I could steal that slide from Dr. Ariola. To move beyond this very individualizing, very pathologizing, and an individual responsibility-based way of thinking about economic empowerment, and also to tap into, as Dr. Friedman was talking about, a bigger grassroots movement. So even moving beyond an immediate community to a larger grassroots movement, and that's something Durbar has certainly done in terms of partnering with other international sex work organizations and trying to create a global movement for social change that then has very personal impacts in terms of health risk, and health behavior. So that's that. That's a lot of information.
I need to go ahead and take the question.
Yeah. Yes. In the back. Mm-hmm.
So I was invited to look at a draft of a policy platform by an American care coalition around decriminalization of sex work.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking to the earlier speakers, the notion of just how you derive a theory of human rights or a ground of human rights, the platform came very close to discussing human rights in terms of body, and rather than from a juridical or legal approach. We might harken back to Thomas Jefferson, but they weren't probably thinking about that type of human rights. But the platform came very close to saying that you, juveniles, would therefore have a right to participate in sex work under this conception of their human rights and their body, and therefore should be decriminalized along with everything else. So my question really is about where we go in terms of that issue from your perspective, or from that discussion of human rights and sort of escaping from the grip of capitalism. So in the community you're discussing, could children participate? And how, what is your thought about that? And one of the critiques of that position is that thinking just for the human experience, there is a developmental vulnerability up to a certain age. We know that from brain science or other things.
Right.
So reflect on that.
Absolutely. I think that's a really interesting question, and certainly a struggle that the Sex Workers Union has dealt with. So their policy now, so as I mentioned, there's a self-regulatory board. So as and the networks of this organization are extremely pervasive through the community. So as folks come in to the red light district, they're sort of intercepted by the organization, and there's very rigid rules about only 18 and over, and we're complete with like physical tests, like bone density tests. Yeah, I think it, some of it is political, because I do think there's also a recognition that 16, 17-year-olds, like an economic reality, complicates sort of how you think about age and work and development. I think there's contextually, it's very, very complicated. And there is the risk that if you say, no, you are not going to be protected under this organization, under this union, that people will do it anyway. However, I think politically, there's an awareness that there's no way that, you know, the organization, and this is from my perspective, I'm not speaking on behalf of the organization, but the organization could receive the sort of support that it does if there were sanctioned 16-year-olds, you know, 14-year-olds working as sex workers in the union. And so I think there's a political element, there's certainly a developmental element, and you know, also a practical element. And so it's not an easy question. It's not necessarily a legal question, because all sex work operates in a very legal gray area in India, or in West Bengal.
I'll take
Okay.
I'll take one more minute.
Yep. I'm wondering what kind of reaction there was from the industry as the union started to organize.
Very dramatic and very negative. So if you think the current operating capital of USHA is about $2.6 million US dollars, all of that money prior to USHA was operating in this gray market. And so there was outright violence. I mean, the original organizers, and it's, we just celebrated the 20-year anniversary of the USHA organization. The early organizers faced risks, faced physical assaults. I have, you know, I did interviews with the founding members who discussed being assaulted, driven out of brothels. It was very dramatic, and it took really persistent, really incredible organizing.